I learned from the beginning, Omer, sorry. I learned from the beginning of Sergei Nyakshin's talk that you can change the title of your talk. This isn't my talk, of course, but so I decided to change this slightly. I just wrote formation and growth of supermassive black holes because it would fit on one line, but that's just for that purpose. But I thought I would change this. Since I haven't, oh, I could do that. No, I thought that would be a bit too obvious. I wanted to leave it up to you as to whether it was organized or not. It could be become self-organized, for example.
It could be critical.
Yeah, and it could be critical. I don't know very much about this topic. I was trying to figure out how to organize it, so I thought maybe we could focus on three different aspects of the subject, which of course are interrelated. The first one being the seeds, the initial collapse event from which these bigger black holes eventually develop. Where's Roger? Oh, there you are, yes. Now, if I were Roger giving this introduction, I would probably then, the second stage would have to be saplings, and then the third stage would be the old growth forest or timber or something like that. Or at least that's how it would come out on the AstroPH write-up. I did this in about 20 minutes before coffee, I thought that the seeds might be black holes, starting at masses, I said maybe 100 solar masses, but then I learned at coffee that it may even be impossible to grow 100 solar mass black holes from POP3, although I don't know how well established that is. But going up perhaps to about 10 to the 4 solar masses. We ultimately, of course, need to get very large black holes, and so there has to be some kind of a transition region consisting of those black holes that have grown considerably from their initial masses, but have not yet become massive enough to have been discovered observationally. We might put those in the, guess that those are in the class of about 1,000 to 1,000,000 solar masses. And for want of a better label, I put into the M sigma segment of the discussion those black holes for which we have some idea of the demographics, perhaps with masses of about 1,000,000 solar masses and up. Now, I wasn't sure whether we should cover these topics in order, because I don't know how much you want to argue about each of these stages, but let me just go through a series of questions that occurred to me about each of these topics, and I'll just be hopefully just a few minutes. So some of the questions for the seed black holes are, first of all, how are they formed? Are they the remnants of population 3 stars, and if they are, what kind of masses do they have? Where did they form? Do they, before we reach the stage when we have the transition era, do they collect together somewhere? Do they all end up by the end, before the transition, in the dark matter cores of pre-galaxies through dynamical friction and merging? And if so, how does that happen? Or do they all form simultaneously with some kind of a gas dynamical process, or even a process involving sticky dark matter or whatever? Dynamical collapse to form these seed black holes. Have all these seed black holes disappeared into bigger black holes, or at least most of them, or is a significant fraction of mass still in the form of seed black holes? And if so, where are they? So are they still among us? Possible locations might be in halos, globular clusters, using the mechanisms perhaps similar to what Cole Miller discussed yesterday. Or perhaps they're in the nuclei of galaxies. And finally, have we discovered these things? Are ultra-luminous X-ray sources the result of accretion onto intermediate mass black holes, which perhaps could be these seed black holes? Again, the topic of Cole's talk yesterday. Okay. The transition period. I was even fuzzier on this. Here's three questions that occurred to me. Merging and accretion is actually going to be, versus accretion is going to be, have to be a topic at each of these stages, right? Black holes can grow by absorbing gas. They can also become larger black holes by merging with other objects that are already black holes. So there is presumably both going on. We know that that galaxies merge, and if the galaxies merge, there may be ways for the black holes to merge also, although that's not guaranteed, especially for the massive black holes. So merging versus accretion, which processes dominate when, at which mass stage? Do all pre-galactic cores contain black holes in this process of rapid growth? Or, for example, do we still have many galactic cores at moderate redshifts, as Kristen Manu suggested yesterday, which need not contain black holes because they can always acquire them later on through some kind of a merging process, and therefore you might have only started out with a minority of the pre-galactic cores containing black holes. This is an epoch where Pete Bender reminded me yesterday is a potentially a very important source of gravitational wave sources, and since it may be difficult to observe these black holes in other ways, for example as discrete accretors, this may be one of the major challenges of gravity wave observatories, to try to reconstruct the history of this era in the evolution of black holes. And then, finally, the M sigma era. I had the most stuff. Well, first of all, I ought to ask at this point, how many of you have a theory for the M sigma relation, for how the M sigma? We could probably use the whole hour. No. Okay. How many of you have five theories for the M sigma relation? I guess Martin's not here, right? Roger has a just. We heard about the M sigma relation yesterday. I think there are still many issues that people may want to discuss. How tight a correlation is it? Exactly what is the correlation? There was quite a bit of discussion of what the slope is yesterday by Laura and Carl. What is or are the fundamental parameters? Laura made the intriguing suggestion that although it looks like it's a correlation with sigma, that may reflect a correlation with a parameter one step back, something related to the formation of halos and the velocities associated with the outer edge of the halo, which in turn could be correlated with the mass of the halo. So in a sense, it may be a mass correlation in the end. If it really is a one-parameter fit, I mean, if there's really one parameter determining the mass of the black hole that we end up with, that really strongly suggests we should be looking for a relatively straight connection between the mechanism that produces the mass and that one parameter. In other words, it should be one main effect that's determining this. And the thing I've tried to keep up with the literature and all these explanations for the M sigma relation, and I find them about, you know, I think they're all comparably compelling. And at some point, there's always a parameter in there. I mean, it varies what that parameter is. I guess that's jumping down to here for a moment. For example, you know, you might have a very well-regulated accretion rate, you know, something related to the Eddington limit or something else. And then, of course, you have to have a specific time scale after which you turn off the accretion so the black hole doesn't get too massive. And then there's always this the dynamical time scale of the core or something like that times the F parameter, which we think is about 0.1. There could be a mass supply where you run out of mass at a certain point and the black hole stops growing. Or there could be a feedback effect. A number of us have been arguing that that black holes are fussy eaters, and that actually a lot of the energy that's released, liberated when matter gets close to the black hole, escapes and prevents additional material from accreting. And so maybe you stop accreting when you dump enough energy back into the surrounding gas to unbind it gravitationally. And of course, the fraction of energy you release is F times the accretion rate times C squared, where F is about 0.1. Maybe we should be looking for something a little bit more compelling or definitive about the regulation effect. We have here also the issue of accretion history versus mergers, and here theorists have to beware because you actually have some observational constraints. We can observe and count. Sum up all the light from quasars, and if we associate that with accretion onto black holes, that suggests that about 30% of the black holes that are in the current census of the M sigma relation, 30% of the mass in black holes in the current census of the M sigma relation probably corresponds to accretion during the quasar era. So a significant amount of the development of the M sigma relation presumably occurs just as a result of radiative accretion. Unless, of course, many of the objects that were quasars are not counted in the M sigma relation. You know, maybe they're extremely massive black holes that are just lurking so far away that we haven't counted any of them yet. I mean, that doesn't sound very likely to me, but you know, I don't know. Can we rule it out? Yeah, you'd see them if they were like 100 megaparsecs away, and inactive, 10 to the 10.5 solar mass black hole. Maybe. Well, okay, here's another aspect. Hard X-ray background. Many people want to explain that by accretion onto type 2 AGNs, hidden objects. It looked to me like that probably accounted for about 60% of the mass in the M sigma relation. Maybe even more. So if you're an optimist, you say we've accounted for everything, and that's it. On the other hand, maybe the X-ray background is a population of low mass black holes that we haven't discovered yet that are below the 10 to the 6 solar masses in the M sigma relation. Just to provoke you, I would suggest maybe we could argue that most growth at Z less than 5 occurs by radiative accretion, that accretion physics sets the M sigma relation, and that in fact mergers fortunately don't seem to destroy it, at least theoretically. And so they just translate the black holes along this this slope without actually playing a role in setting what that relationship is. Just one more slide, actually two-thirds of a slide. Okay, what happens at the mass, high mass and low mass end where we don't actually have a correlation? I mentioned this question of 10 to the 10 and greater black solar mass black holes. Low mass black holes, I think, is considerably more uncertain. If you get much below about 10 to the 5, they could still be sitting out in halos. Dynamical friction would not necessarily have gotten them into the centers of galaxies unless they carried a tightly bound halo of stuff which made them appear more massive and gave them more dynamical friction. So low mass black holes could be hiding in halos or in the IGM. Perhaps at some stage they were accreting, maybe they were responsible for the X-ray background, and therefore we could handle a lot more of the current mass distribution being created by hierarchical merging. And we wouldn't have that problem of accounting for all the mass, if that's a problem, by accretion that we can see. And then finally, where are the black hole binaries? They have to be there. There's no direct evidence of black hole binaries in any AGNs, as far as I know, or in other galaxies from dynamical effects. Stellar dynamical theories of black hole binary evolution suggest that there may be a bottleneck which prevents them from ever getting closer than about a tenth of a parsec, but there are possibly stellar dynamical or gas and gas dynamical fixes, which seem to me pretty plausible, which can allow them to spiral together quite quickly, so maybe you don't see them because they don't last very long. They come right together. Okay, that's all I want to say. So, which topic shall we start with? The low mass to high mass, or should we work backwards? Roger.
Yes. An interesting question to ask of the observer.
and see if there's agreement on this. In which mass of black hole most of the black hole mass are residing on the presumption that you're seeing essentially all of it in the nuclei of galaxies?
Well, then that just depends on the galaxy of the velocity function, which will be about 10 to 6 or 10 to 6.
So,
a few 10 to 6.
I mean, it's going to be, you think, a few tenths of a sixth. If you had the
McCarthy
effect, it'd be higher than that.
I
wonder if there's an agreement between you and Laura about this.
Yeah, we actually did those things.
So it's really, really? The low mass end of the observation, if all the masses...
I thought it corresponded to L-star galaxies.
Because your sort of limits come from the quasar.
Okay, previous slide. I'm surprised by that because, I mean, Isaac Schlossman and I were trying to work this out last week, and we had the impression it was closer to the black holes that correspond to L-star galaxies, where the distribution turns over. And that would be about 10 to the 8.
That was what was said in the past, and that's why...
Well, those are the papers we read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Depends on whether you want numbers or mass.
No.
Mass.
That's right. So if you want mass, you weight the Schechter function by...
Yeah, that corresponds to less than L star.
The luminosity function rises toward low mass objects, so most of the black holes are 10 to the 6.
Yeah,
but
that wasn't
the
mass.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. So most of the mass is 10.
Well, that disagrees with Carl and Laura.
L star would be about 8 times the
pressure. Might be.
10
to the 8, yeah.
Well, now you have to consider... Well, there's an issue with...
Yeah?
You have to include the whole life in here, so now I'm trying to not figure out that whole thing.
Let's do ellipticals.
There are two ways of doing this. One is to take on the front. One of these L versus the L versus the figure and some other correlations, and then just do a analytical base test and do nothing about it. The other is to take the census of galaxies that we observe in our neighborhood and do the maximum likelihood estimator. And just say after some radius we've got these galaxies and we want some selection functions and all the rest of it, and then try and do it directly. Maybe you're getting a different answer by using the second method. That must be what's going on.
I haven't done the second method, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Don't we know from nearby galaxies that you can't just take the luminosity and scale by the mass? Obviously, in nearby galaxies, if you look at the luminosity of that star, you would underestimate the mass by orders of magnitude. That's true for most non-active galaxies.
Well, presumably, the quasars still have to be massive black holes. I mean, because they're very luminous.
Yeah, but if you just take the luminosity function and you extrapolate all the way to the lower luminosity, then that's telling you directly the mass. I think you'd be underestimating the mass.
Right, but I thought that this estimate comes from looking at the mass function of nearby galaxies and applying the M-sigma relation, right? Yeah. So it just... Right. Could you please speak up when you make your case? It's difficult to hear here. Okay. I was wondering if I think that perhaps the trickiest part of this whole thing is how you get from these seed black holes to these gigantic, massive black holes that obviously dominate at least the inner regions of cores of galaxies. And I was wondering if people had some ideas about that. Roger, you don't don't be shy.
I'll try an idea. I don't have much confidence in this. I think it may be more productive to deflect the attention of the observers by asking them questions.
Yes.
In terms of one possible way of growing these black holes gas dynamically, Mitch gave the alternative of having some sort of catastrophic collapse where everything comes down to a million solar mass black hole, and then that you might ask whether or not it could produce mega gamma ray bursts or something at the same time. Or alternatively, you could build them up by mergers without necessarily much radiative display, just gravitational radiation. But if you take the view that they sort of grew from 10 to 100 solar mass black holes made perhaps in the very early universe, and then grew to a million solar masses when we could start paying attention to them, then it obviously requires a lot of EPOL winds, and there may not be enough time if you rigorously obey the Eddington limit, will tell you is not necessarily required. But if you take an old-fashioned view that speed limits and so on should be obeyed, then there may not be quite enough EPOL winds to make to a million solar masses and then grow to a billion solar masses, which is what you need for the big quasars at the rate of the six.
Well. Sorry, Elliot, could you speak?
There is enough time to get the Sloan high resolution quasar from solar mass to black hole to reasonable cosmology collapsing at a rate of 10 or 15.
So they have to start beyond 10?
I'm trying to where they start.
Well, I mean, you can do that with low efficiency.
No. He did it at self intercon with 10%.
Well, you're unlikely to have low efficiency if you're really accreting at the Eddington limit. Yeah, the E-folding times 400 is 40 million years.
Yeah, 4 times 10.
40 million years. So,
to get at redshift 6, even at 10 to 10 solar masses.
Yeah. You only need 25 E-foldings.
You may have just about enough time.
Yeah. So you have to start right away and grow at the Eddington rate.
Right,
yes.
That's an issue then. Is that what you think is the way that they're built up, just by accreting steadily at the Eddington?
Well, I'm not sure. You can't quite rule that out.
I guess one of the things that I would say is you should be seeing more high redshift quasars to be progenitor of the ones that are building up around the Eddington telescope.
Can I clear that up? The only sequence that there are 10 to 10 to 10 to 10 to 10 to 10.
Yeah, but you have to.
I would have thought you couldn't see them out there.
It's the growth of the luminosity function with redshift that is constrained. I don't know what the thing was down to the question.
Pete, did you?
It seemed to me the real point in that argument is there's only a factor two difference in the number of doubling times you need whether you start from 10 to the 5th or 100. And it's just, we don't know things that well.
Well, do we really think that the seeds have to be as small as a couple of solar masses? I mean, what's reasonable for POP 3, Bob?
Is there any light left in the old idea that if you start with a beam-mass object and fragment, that could be coupling using mass spectrum? Is there any light left in that idea? I think this paper by Ed O'Brien and Norman is really quite important in this case. I don't know if it'll survive or not, but at present it sounds like it's a real contribution. They find that the critical mass function for population 3 between 30 and 300 solar mass. And there's a preprint by Madow and Reese where they, about 6 months ago, where they talk about what will happen with these things. They estimate there might be of the order of 10 to the 4th of these in the mass the size of our present galaxy, and that maybe 1% of them are formed close enough to the center of the spheroid so they end up getting in less than 100 times. So there are a number of these 100 solar mass projectiles wandering.
But Roger told me that you can't go over 50 for the black hole.
The story is that the initial black hole, the main population 3, at least I think it was 50 or 100 solar masses is what they now think for an individual one. And that doesn't stop 100 of them agglomerating in the center, as you just said.
to get them in quick enough to get them started. But I thought that their mass on, I thought it was 30 to 300.
Right, that's for the stars, but the higher mass stars only go repair production supernova, which assembles the whole star, doesn't leave a black hole remnant.
I thought if there were over 200 solar mass, then it could leave 100 solar mass remnant. That's where
well, 100, yes, about 50 or 100 is about the maximum remnant that they can make. Well, they can't make thousands.
So suppose they make 50, are they going to be, tend to be clustered when they're made so that you rapidly merge them and get something much bigger anyway? So, you know, you do it at the bottom of a dark matter potential well.
Well, their argument was that these are being formed from 3 sigma density peaks, and therefore they would tend to be in the center of the galaxy. And so that helps a lot in getting some in, but I just don't think you get enough in to do much that way. It seems to me that the other main contenders are formation in clusters of some kind, runaway collapse and so forth, or collisions of 10 solar mass things that gradually build up, or the one big cloud that collapses. But the one big cloud, it seems to me, has some trouble if the population 3 stars were already formed, and they have sort of determined their location and so forth. And I'm not sure that you really can
have
10 to the 7th solar mass clouds collapse after that.
I'm confused about something. If you form 50 solar mass black holes in a cluster, why would you then have all of them collide and form a bigger black hole and not have the process that Steve was talking about where you just form binaries, they don't collide. You just form binaries and you start ejecting the single 50 solar mass black hole. What's the difference? Why would you end up...
It depends on how much mass you have in your cluster. If the potential is deep enough, you don't eject it. So principally, you can segregate it out, which you can have a very rapid evolution of this. In fact, this is one of the things that everyone's glad to agree about. That's basically a relativistic cluster of stars in principle.
Oh, yes, yes. It must have been in there, yes. A lot of people are saying there's observational evidence for 100 or 1,000 solar mass black holes in these ultra-luminous X-ray sources. Are those really 100 or 1,000 solar mass black holes? Or, for example, is it they're beaming or maybe even super Eddington luminosities? I mean, you know.
The thing that I think is very interesting about these 50 or 100 solar mass objects is however you're growing something in the center, if it's growing by collisions of 10 solar mass things initially, if it is going through the sort of 10 to the 4th solar mass range and one of these other things come in, that would give you a signal you could see at any redshift, basically. So that there's a chance of actually seeing events that tell you what's going on in terms of the growth of the intermediate mass black holes.
So would you be able really to sort out the history of the merging process? And
if you have enough events to do statistics, yes.
Any other comments on this stuff? What about the growth into the next mass range?
Actually, can I
ask sure.
Back up, what do you think is first?
Well, they range apparently from one solar mass up to many. I don't know. Yeah?
Well, I mean, maybe I can mention something I've been kind of wondering about, which is if you think of a lot of our clusters, then they have fairly short relaxation times, especially for massive objects. You can have lots of segregation and interaction, but as Simone pointed out, they also have shell potential, so they kick stuff out. And unless you have decent seed to begin with, you're not going to be growing much. On the other hand, if you go all the way to a large galactic bulk, the relaxation times are long, so you're not able to collect and grow. What about intermediate ranges of, something in between, 10 to the 8 solar masses? Is this the ideal breeding ground for this sort of dynamical collection?
Well, I was wondering why did Zoltan assume start at a redshift of 10 or 15? Presumably you can form globular clusters earlier than that. I mean, redshift of 100 or a few hundred.
Well, it doesn't make a difference between the Z of 10 and Z of 100.
Well, you have longer e-folding time. You don't even have to accrete it at an Eddington rate. Well, there's not that much time. You're right. Yeah.
Non-linear
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
20 is the earliest? Okay. And actually, there isn't much time. So that's it's moot. Yes.
I asked John's question, isn't it true that the first seeds were on relatively small mass scale, three sigma fluctuations and so on, which are going to create the populations of three stars in their center? And as Peter emphasized, that they themselves are intrinsically quite strongly clustered. So they can be overrepresented in what eventually become galaxies.
The core is the galaxy.
The core is the galaxy, yeah, that's right.
So that's the consensus view.
Well, one argument is they already have been found, although clearly the details of get where they are, how their fuel been as Coral emphasized yesterday, are not at all clear, but it's conceivable that some of the
Well, there is another issue with forming these things at low masses. Which is that they're going to be collected together by hierarchical merging, and if they're too low mass, they're not going to make their way into the nucleus ever. So they could still be there. So I'm wondering what kind of constraints, first of all, can we put on relic black holes that are sitting in halos? I mean, how much of this mass, for example, how much mass per cubic megaparsecs could there be in black holes of less than 10 to the 5 solar masses, which might have been responsible for some accretion luminosity? You know, if it's a large amount of mass, it could be responsible for some of the background radiation. How much of that could you hide, and at what mass range? Roger?
Again, I think people probably know more about this than anybody, but my impression was that looking at about the 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 6th solar mass black hole, you can rule out observationally, apart from any other consideration, that they're made exclusively black holes, the halos. But about the, they might have 1% or 10%, you really can't rule out anything. The best bounds I know are things like using gravitational lenses, looking at other background sources, particularly the radio sources, through the halos of other galaxies. And if there's a lot of black holes there, then you produce microlens structure in the images of the background radio sources, which isn't seen. So beyond that, I think there are arguments based on survival of the binaries and so on, but then really not very strong. There's probably not a very strong observational objection to having our galaxy, for example, having 10 solar masses as pretty massive black holes. You probably couldn't rule that out. You might have prejudices as to whether that could have ever happened, but on purely observational grounds, I'm not sure there's any very good evidence against, maybe people didn't know more about the who know stronger arguments. But most of the arguments that have been produced have in fact not survived.
Well, if you saw a method of hierarchical merging from, say, making star clusters, making the black holes in star clusters, and push those into the black hole center, and then make a bigger black hole out of that, and it's just a picture of hierarchical merging, then a lot of star clusters will not make it into the galactic center. You can have a lot of these thousand solar mass black holes bubbling around without a star cluster, and typically relatively close to the galactic center. And what kind of observational constraints can you put on that? That would be what interests me very much.
Could one calculate the rate at which they could acquire binary companions and then accrete from them?
No, I would say very little, because very few of them have binary companions. They probably have to accrete from the interstellar medium locally, relatively close to the galactic center.
That's probably too low a rate.
To smash into to a molecular cloud or so. I mean, that's of course also a possibility.
But you wouldn't get a high enough accretion rate. Yeah, but I mean, look at the ultra-luminous X-ray sources. There's 10 of them in the antennae galaxies, and there are other galaxies which have multiple versions of these. Milky Way and Andromeda don't have any. They seem to be associated with H2 regions. Could these have been primordial intermediate mass black holes that have managed to capture companions? Could you get 10 of them, for example, in the disk of the antenna?
Maybe.
Yeah, I know what you think. Yes.
In that case, if it's essential that they be interacting with molecular clouds, for example, the question would be, does this mean the antennae and M82, for example, have 10 times the molecular gas that Milky Way and Andromeda do?
So you're saying they're not binaries?
No, I'm saying that, in my opinion, you basically have to be, you have to be associated with star formation regions, and that's associated with molecular gas. So
they have to be moving extremely slowly relative to the molecular material. Otherwise, the Bondi rate is too low if they're moving at any significant speed.
No. I'm not saying Bondi.
Okay.
Fine, they have to be near star clusters in order to acquire binary companions. I'm assuming those are either now or 2 billion years ago associated with molecular gas. So,
yeah, but then star cluster is gone. There's no way to get new binary companions. And then you go to that, that's over.
Chris.
I believe it's true. The open sources are actually associated generically with star cluster galaxies.
Could you speak up, please?
You see more than objects in Star Wars galaxy, so surely that would argue against the just the relics seen floating around the region, smashing into the molecular clouds. Would that be a much more random phenomenon? Plus, if it, that would argue for it being much more closely connected with the star formation process than being connected
with the process. I'm not quite following that argument. You need to gather one point in
John, speak up, please.
I
never thought I'd hear myself say that. Well, I think it's a pretty egregious difference. You know, there's 10 of them in the 10 and none of them known in our galaxy.
Well, there are more galaxies. I mean, NQ1 has 6 of them. NQ10, NQ8 has about 6 as well. Mm-hmm. So, really, a very strong correlation with stuff.
Yeah.
Are we pretty much convinced that these are uranium mass black holes as opposed to something else like holes? Microblazars, which have been predicted, that they would, a microblazar would be a pencil of mass object, but a jet be a turbulent being to work with it.
Yes, but Rob.
Several of these sources have quite soft anterior spectrum. The soft anterior spectrum is a focal state, and they suggest that they would be a I think they're not sources where anterior can be.
Roger, do you have a comment?
I'm going to ask Rob. If any of these fugitive galactic lasers are radio sources, have people looked at them by radio emission? That's what you would expect, because I mean, the history of extragalactic astronomy, which apparently concerns radio emission, then found an interesting camera.
That's right, there's no clear identification of any of the radio sources. If some of them were as bright as, for example, Sigma Set 3, it would be a black hole being more of a galaxy, then you should see them.
Sorry? Yeah? Oh, suggest it. But could they be beamed without producing jets? I mean, for example, just in some optically thick way. Andrew King has a model which does that.
And they don't have to be beamed in the sense of relativistically beamed. They just have to be anisotropically emitted. So the factors you require are not huge. These guys are not enormously super-emitted. The one in M82, I think, is a real problem on its own. And I think that's the only one. The others, I think, are not.
Well, 10 to the 41 would be 30 times the Eddington limit if you had an outlier black hole of 20 or 30 solar masses.
As you suggest, yeah. Then I think even that one's on the problem.
What about extremely high accretion rates? Can you turn these seeds into moderate mass black holes, say, bringing them from 100 solar masses up to 10 to the 4 or 5 in a fairly short time. Roger?
Yes.
See? So that's two models. Sorry, three, or is it three?
Just a thought on that. Well, there is one possible dimensionless ratio. If you manage to get into a space when you accrete so rapidly, the trapping radius, sort of m-dot over m-dot Eddington, the transfer radius, exceeds the bond, effective Bondi radius, then that can only really happen for low-mass black holes. Then the sort of character of the accretion changes,
and that might be easier to have a sort of catastrophic accretion under the very rapid accretion under those circumstances to make as high as sort of sigma cubed over g necessary, which is of course very fast. And then that would switch off when you've got like some sort of intermediate mass, like about 10 to the 4th solar masses, and then you would continue to accrete perhaps at an Eddington-limited rate or a bit higher if Mitch is right, you can meet the Eddington limit.
And how little angular momentum do you need for that to happen?
Probably not. You can't have very much angular momentum. I think it would be hard to do it if you have a lot of angular momentum.
What's the angular momentum in these cores? Does anybody know what it's predicted to be from simulations? This is one worry I've had, is I really don't have a very good feel for at what point the angular momentum kicks in and turns this from Bondian accretion into something where you have to get rid of angular momentum. Do you know, Elliot?
Well, again, you could imagine it being very chaotic, the early stages of the growth of the galactic nucleus. There may be some phases when the gas you have acting at the Bondi radius, in fact, doesn't have much angular momentum. Another phase is when it has a lot. And it could be you don't need very long to build up. And that's just a relatively small duty cycle in the sort of billion or so years you've got available. A
couple of infall times. But, I mean, if you had streams of gas or winds going past, you know, and it really is chaotic, would you ever have a small enough angular momentum so that when the stuff collected, you wouldn't end up with a disk? I find that a real challenge. I'm just worried. That's the part I'm worried about.
I don't know how often it would happen, but obviously two streams that collided and created a lot of gas that had relatively little angular momentum.
Of course, your black hole grows by a factor of 1,050 years or something like that, right? From 100 to 10 to the 5. I think that's roughly what it works out to. It's about a million Eddington limits. Million times the Eddington limit.
Yeah. If you try to do this at the maximum rate of C cubed over G, then it would happen quite fast.
So you could. Right. Yeah. And in fact, you can get a sort of a self-similar growth where the Bondi radius increases linearly with time, the black hole mass increases with time, and it all goes up. Yeah. But angular momentum could mess that up.
Yeah.
Has anybody else worried about this sort of stuff?
The only thing that I have is I think it's not necessarily logical to conclude that you have to make the seed black holes in the same way for the ones that are going to form things like R. Galactic center black hole and things like the quasars at B=4. I think it's quite possible nature has several ways of doing this.
Any other comments on this? Yeah, Andrew, What about the relative importance of merging and accretion and where and when that occurs? How worried are people looking at the M sigma relation? First of all, you know, is this such a tight correlation that there really has to be one basic mechanism behind it, and someday we might find it and that will be that and it'll be obvious? Or is it going to be just a combination of many different things that sort of look similar and it's going to be a big mess? Which, you know, could, well, I mean, you know, what do you, do you think we're on the right, the papers that have appeared suggest, you know, explaining it, are they on the right track? Is it, do you think it's a feedback effect? That's one class of models. Do you think it's, one might ask, some models I've seen are supply limited, in which it has to do with the inner part of the galaxy, and the, you know, the last little bit of the galaxy gets into the center and forms the black hole, and the mass is determined by just the structural properties of the halo and the gas inside it? Or is it demand limited, where the black hole can only absorb matter at a certain rate, and then it turns off, and it maybe because it reaches some limit in the ability of the black hole to absorb matter, or perhaps because the energy, the feedback, the energy that's liberated by gravity as the gas falls in, gets enough of that gets out into the surroundings to affect the gas and stop it from coming in. I mean, and there have even been suggestions that the energy, the feedback from the black hole could actually regulate the properties of the galactic halo. These are, seem to me to be very different kinds of models, and they all predict the same M sigma relation, or at least one of the two M sigma relations. You know, and Roger then predicts the one with the exponent of 2 or 5/3. Or
someone who pleads guilty to having
it's model 4.
The demand side rather than the supply side, and the sort of extreme version of this, as Mitch has just said. That the energy that is released by the galactic center, probably in the form of a wind, could actually impact the gas in the surrounding galaxy halo, and even in extreme cases, control the morphology of the galaxy, the sort of extreme version of this hypothesis. I still think that, although it goes against the sort of standard view of galaxy formation, I still think it's something that's worth thinking about and worth at least trying to rule out observationally. And one of the ways of addressing this is to try and understand how the type of quasar is associated with the morphology of the host galaxy. And there have been a long history of this, of sort of conflicting reports. Matt Molkin, who's here, has worked on this in the past. More recently, McClure and Dunlop and others have made claims that the big quasars are all associated with ellipticals and so on. I can ask the observers here if they could give us some guidance on what the how the morphology of the host galaxy is related now to the either the mass of the central black hole or the luminosity of the active nucleus. Matt, do you want to try that?
I thought that it's still very much on the table that there's a preference, maybe not an absolute requirement, but that the radio allows.
But we also have McClure has is a sample of lower redshift galaxies where you can go further down the luminosity function and be more confident about the morphology. I think there have been more recent papers on McClure, which I haven't read. I don't know whether
they still find that the quasar activity is much more probable in more luminous host galaxies.
And what about radio activity versus optically? But that could mean that they're just in ellipticals, and ellipticals are more massive.
But the bulges are small compared to the black hole mass. That's in radio level.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Now, it could be a biased sample, but. If you plot the radioness as a function of offset from the black hole signal correlation, mm-hmm. The correlation with the more the radio level galaxies are offset. The higher black hole
compared to what you'd predict from the properties of the bulges of the sigma. What about the shape of the cores of these galaxies? Do they tend to be the flattened cores, or are they the cuspy cores? Do we know anything about the morphologies of these cores, or can we simply not tell? Matt? The radio galaxies are the flat ones. Okay. Eric. Can you speak up? Well, this is something I wanted to raise, this question of whether black hole spin is responsible for radio activity. And therefore, I mean, the spin of the black hole is probably sensitive to the merger history, right? If it's a lot of minor mergers, you probably spin down the hole. If it's accretion or major mergers, you could spin up the hole. So if it's major mergers, then you might get a fairly major mergers, then you might get a flattened elliptical core, if you, according to these ideas that you get heating of the stellar distribution from the in spiral. So I wonder if it's feasible to start to try to correlate those kinds of things, the morphology of the core.
Yeah. The earlier work by people like Longair and Heckman had it that the harmful radio source of rounds back to outside clusters. The FRP is meant to be outside clusters in low density environments. Mm-hmm. And that is my impression of the way so that other than that quasar, I'm talking about local radio galaxy.
Right. I'm referring to Terry Jones, Steve Rollins has some given large data set where they put that radio bar.
Well, how much do we think FR2 versus FR1 distinction depends on environment? I mean, there is a correlation with radio power, but presumably radio power has an efficiency factor in it that might depend sensitively on environment. I know that there's some work on the effects of environment on the appearance of microquasars, and Sebastian has been working on that. Do you want to?
If you look at, this is just comparing microquasars and radio jets, so it might not relate directly, but if you compare jets from low mass black holes versus jets from high mass black holes, it turns out that environment has to be at a much higher density. Typically, you don't find in galactic environments. So, dynamically, compared to high mass black holes, microquasars are low density equivalent. They are comparable, or even to the most extreme giant radio galaxies. And so, I guess that would relate in this sense that due to the low mass black hole, in order for it to be dynamically comparable to a very high mass black hole, it would have to be at a higher density.
So the microquasars look like disembodied hotspots.
Well, if you see a hotspot, the problem is because they're much bigger, the emission that comes from the microquasar is much different, which is the reason why you might not expect to see any radio emission from microquasars.
Why do you think there are not several microquasars?
Well, I guess these are. I guess I'm talking about object like the aircraft, where we have a powerful jet, we don't need any associated control.
Not 1950s, I thought we were two after IRAS sources on either side, either end.
Right. So extrapolating back to the supermassive cases, you might imagine that in the dense cluster environments, you'd go over to a type 1 much more easily, maybe. No?
Well, if mergers have anything to do with it, then of course, in the dense cluster environments, mergers happened a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Anybody? Oh, yeah, Dave.
One thing people should think about is that the production, if black hole stem is jet enough time, probably a constraint, like I said, it does, then the production of the jet might spin down the black hole. It might salvage a significant amount of its rotational energy and spin it down unless there's a burden.
So you don't think accretion can replenish it?
No, I don't think so. Especially if accretion is from random stars.
Well, suppose it's from accretion disk, from a big, you know, maybe the accretion episodes occur when the black hole tears apart a molecular cloud. And that provides enough for a million years, just right there.
It's still a black hole, but then you're raising it at the same time, some power, and that will spin a lot. So to me, the only way to spin a lot fast is with a merger. Maybe a merger at the vertical for a time scale. And then that would occur at the galaxy.
Chris. That sounds reasonable to me. Roger, and then Eric.
Let's take the hypothesis that they mentioned that radioactivity is a consequence of merger that we spin up the black hole. Let's adopt Carlin's oracle for that theoretical meaning of the two relations or whatever. In the then a quantitative prediction, the amount of number of mergers one actually happening now. In sort of as a redshift where you can actually see them occurring to account for the sort of intermediate redshift radio luminosity function. Could you actually say that you should actually see these mergers taking place?
Well,
and one of the things is that I think you look at, you obviously see evidence of interacting galaxies and so on, but do you see enough major mergers taking place in the galaxies that you see in galaxy surveys?
Why couldn't the mergers have occurred in the distant past? And then the black hole sits there and spins until you apply a clutch. I mean, you know, it sits there, and then every million or 10 million years, a molecular cloud comes by and sort of provides an accretion disk, or some gas comes in as a result of a merger, and you only tap the spin at that point.
I think because you tend to see radioactivity in the nuclei, the giant radio sources, at all times. You get sort of these coreless bubbles.
The doubles fade out very quickly. I mean, I think they fade out in a time that's comparable to the time they were on. I would say maybe 10 million years. But you know, maybe they're only active every 100 million years for 10 million years. Then basically you only you're right. There is some probability. Yes. Some of them.
They have cores. You can use maybe 7, for example. There's some energy parts suggested that under one major merger of 4 or 5 each.
Chris.
Another observation which I can make, I'm very prone to myself on the
some complex infrastructure, very small wave galaxies, very, very young wave galaxies, thousands of years old, and we lose the morphology of those galaxies. Now, those galaxies actually didn't look all that straight. They certainly weren't in the process of an ongoing merger. And it seems that it couldn't have been any constrained by the past 10 to 8 years.
Yeah. I agree that one of the things that slightly surprises me about the large age of professional galaxy, you would lose some people here, I think, apparent, but they very fixated on what happens in the cores of these galaxies and changes in colors and so on. They never look at the outer eyes of those, it's all extraordinarily relaxed. So there had been a lot of merger activity, you would expect to see these relatively moving to the outer eyes of those, which is my understanding.
Most of us think that it's mergers that spin up the black holes as opposed to long episodes of accretion. If you change the... No, probably... Right? Sir? Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't anybody want to argue about the X-ray background? Or Eric, did you have a... So what's the other ingredient? What's the other ingredient besides spin? You need spin plus X. Well, what is it, Dave? Accreted magnetic field. You think the magnetic field's accreted? The dynamo inside the disk, it's just created in situ. The same in all disks. Why not? What about radio quasars? So those are 10 to the 11th solar mass black holes?
I don't know.
Roger. Roger, speak up. If it's major enough merger. What was the answer? Sorry. Oh, no answer. Oh. Yes, right. Okay.
Let's suppose we have a very small black hole, and it's resulting under gravitational radiation from around the orbit than you've ever been, then as a function of the mass ratio and the A over M of the big black hole, do we have a distribution of the initial A over M, do we have a distribution of the final A over M?
Oh, that's enough.
Could that be computed at all using some of the approximate? Surely it can be done in that high mass ratio.
Done now.
But could it then be approximated? Because that would be of some use in trying to formulate some observational hypotheses that could be tested by looking at the instant conversion or something like that.
I tend to assume most general sizes anyway that blue just cannot become natural and no more. But there's really no good reason for that. I mean, kind of conservative amount of radiation that will come on. Presumably calculations at some point, truly calculations
become that's a valid population. Right, that becomes for an equal mass merger, right? If you're talking about a height, like even a 10 to 1 mass ratio, you start with a low dimensional mass of that hole, that's not an issue.
No, yeah, right. 10 to 1 mass, I mean, I think that's going to be, it's going to be relatively few cases that are going to be equal mass. To make, I mean, 3 to 1 may be the typical case. And in that case, you might be able to chance your arm a little bit.
Yeah.
In doing the expansion and so on, and you probably assume the inclination was more or less being maintained.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Eric, I start.
Probably. It might actually be useful for this community too, if something say, plan
out. I was writing my Yes, Eric.
Okay, this is not the function of the screen, because you can start with non-spinning letter initially and get the final.
Oh, sure.
Right.
It's a question.
It's not a function of the speed, 3.03. So,
yeah. The equal mass case, but I'm thinking sort of different case might be a mass ratio of 3.
So we have to have in mind that the limit for mass will not be a function of the initial speed. So this is what,
in the most stable circular orbit, obviously, there is where you prograde, retrograde, and so on. Yeah, right.
But that is exactly the mass ratio of 3 or 2.
Yeah. No, you put it or something like that, and then that might do something for testing this hypothesis. But spin just comes from mergers and nothing else.
Eric.
So you mentioned the question of what is the missing ingredient, and one thing that arises in my mind in the ambient medium is, for example, the collimation actually depends somehow on the outer boundary. And I wonder, in the simulations which show collimation,
Well, sure. What kind of confinement do you need? Well, I mean, M87 jet is observed with VLBI at 100 Schwarzschild radii. It's already collimated. So maybe it's collimated by the wind coming out further, coming off the disk further out. Sorry?
Inside 100 Schwarzschild radii, it may not be wrong.
Well, yeah.
But surely the large scale features around that are going on.
I think a crucial question that one has to try to answer is whether the things that are not radio loud try to be radio loud out to 10 or 15 or 100 Schwarzschild radii and then something turns off the jet, or whether they never create any sort of outflow like that. Chris.
The other ingredient to that is that no radio loud object gets shown in relative timeline.
No radio loud object at all? And also luminous, also quasars.
Yeah, I should have to show you the 3T2s and the 3 earlier, there's no overall
line. But also radio quiet quasars, right?
But it's not, but even if you go to moderate luminosity radio loud, you can go to like broad line radio galaxies, some of them may show moderate. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that may argue for the inner disk being thick or hot or some state that can't produce such.
Do you think that that's related to the apparent absence of type 2 objects at high luminosities, which might be relevant for the question of how many of the quasars we actually see? Is there a population of quasars which are accreting a large amount of mass but we haven't identified them as individual objects. And you know, maybe they're related to the hard X-ray background, as some people have suggested. But nobody here apparently wants to discuss. Is there do we see all of the luminous AGN? And if we go down the luminosity distribution, at what point do we think there might be a large population of objects we don't see as individual sources? Well, I mean, there's some information about how much quasar light that is versus star formation, right?
That's very
nice. What is it? I mean, is it about 50-50?
Yeah, louder.
Yeah. Louder. Yes.
It's a mixture of objects. Some of the stars are so much. But only now people are beginning to actually understand what AGN might so be very good.
Matt, loud. Speak up.
A large fraction of the total accretion power in the universe could be in these objects. They might be just sort of secret luminosity, but you never see the secret luminosity better. Maybe not even in the hard X, maybe in the hard X barely. Mostly coming out somewhere in the mid-infrared in this rather nondescript form. It doesn't really have a clear signature. I was originally accretion.
Well, if that's happening, then it's leaving behind black holes that maybe have a total mass of approaching 10 to the 6 solar masses per cubic megaparsec. Where are they? Those have not been counted yet. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm worrying about. Yeah. Anybody want to take that up? Roger?
It's not quite a related question, and again, I'm just trying to, a few observers here are learning the opposite observation. The broad absorption line quasar.
Ah, good, yes.
One hypothesis is those are conspicuously, but not completely, not radio sources, although there's some exceptions to that rule now being found, I think. But if you sort of say they're mostly not, they're failures as radio sources, are those the objects being supplied with gas much faster than the Eddington rate? Because a large rate doesn't know about the Eddington rate, and they have giant outposts where the surplus mass is expelled. Is there any good argument against that sort of relatively simple hypothesis?
Well, the only argument is a very old traditional one. The Wyman et al. Paper from 1991 that tells you that as far as the broadline region, the emission line, there is really no much difference between broad absorption quasars and any other form of quasar. Now, if you can tell me that the broad emission line region would not suffer from having a much higher accretion rate, then all bets are off.
But if you see it, it's only a few hundred solar masses of gas illuminated by the same generic ultraviolet spectrum, you could argue that it shouldn't be very different. It's just controlled by atomic physics.
I agree.
Provided you can see it, I guess,
is
the issue.
Why do you suggest that? You said that they were super Eddington? Fed at a super Eddington rate? But probably it's line pressure that's driving the winds more than electron scattering pressure. So the effective Eddington limit is higher, is lower than the electron scattering Eddington limit.
Ultimately, I think, as Nahum and others have shown, there's a very good case to be made that the velocity by radiation pressure acting on the spectral line. So maybe initially what pushes the gas out of the potential well maybe more have more to do with electron scattering capacity. Now, who do you want to comment on that?
I think it's definitely possible, but I think the person that could maybe answer that better is Daniel Progress sitting on the back. He's actually doing the hard 2D time-dependent model.
Speak up, Daniel.
We assume that the mass is being of the European heating part of this, then the lines are important. And then the gas is being elevated above the hill, that gas can, you know,
solarization from the center can be ionized and loop the line and then if anything driven by that
then have you account for the sort of correlate sort of features that have been recorded.
About that mission?
The current line marking is gone.
Yeah, the radiation line marking and stuff like that. Well, that it's still up to be seen. I will favor models that radiation acceleration will do the most of the driving from several hundred kilometers a second all the way up to many tens of thousands, and that will work in favor of what you suggest, because the initial train is actually much hotter, or a hot kind of the wind, or driven by radiation by Thomson scattering, it can be similar.
Well, do we have any mass estimates for BAL quasars?
Well, not really. That's the problem. I'll talk about it a little bit on Thursday, but currently we are in a little bit of an abysmal situation where the mass flux in bulky solids is uncertain to about 8 orders of magnitude.
That's nothing.
And the reason is because really the distances we have distances between 0.1 parsecs to 1,000 parsecs, and the cone density is the one we get from the UV at 10 to the 20, and some of the X-rays still claim 10 to the 24. So you add 4 orders of magnitude, you get about 8. So there is a lot of work to be seen and things to be done on that and actually lower the uncertainty down to an acceptable level.
Okay. Sorry? I asked about the masses of the black hole, yes.
Oh, sorry.
Daniel.
Very briefly, I would like to come back to the point that you said about that. What will happen if you supply masses at higher rate than the lower? So I cannot answer this question, but I can say that even if the mass accretion rate is below that, by say, it's 50% of that. The radiation for light is very effective in blowing most of this material off the wall. Like by 50%, that's a fairly large distance from the black hole. So I think that there's a feedback to how much you might supply and how much you blow away. So what fraction of the energy rate do you think that the maximum rate of the black hole can go? What fraction of the energy rate?
10 times.
Well, I can't really make an excuse.
Well, I mean, surely, sorry, go ahead. Well, a few people, I mean, many people believe that most radio quiet quasars are BAL quasars when viewed from certain directions. And in fact, some radio loud quasars, if not most, may also be BAL quasars from certain directions. So I think you're really talking about the whole population of quasars with this extra tracer that results from a favored orientation, I think. Or Julian?
Well, you just... in answer to whether BALs are a special population or something, what is that? It seems that actually, in some ways, the clearest evidence is the separate polar limit, which indicates that there has to be. In those cases, it's got to be an orientation. And the absorbing material is organized on that. So there must be parts of those that we see as ordinary regular. And because BAL is somewhere in the 10% range of the discovered population, then the part will be something that's impressionable.
David?
But there is a problem. BAL quasars, they used to be, all quasars were radio quiet, and, but some radio loud objects were found. But I think that's a red herring, as exactly. It turns out that all quasars are still deficit in radio loud objects compared to the rest of the population. So it will be a strange effect if it was only due to orientation. At least this is the claim of the first people that the radio.
This is the first survey.
Yeah.
Do you know about, can you answer that?
I agree.
So you really think that they are radio quiet, primarily?
Well, there's definitely no bulkier solids shows with very high radioluminosity. And the dichotomy is still there, it's just it's somewhat lower, and there are some objects that are definitely radioluminous. But
Roger, yes.
In terms of the Max Lambrecht, the Max Lambrecht is just a theory that Ray Wyman, when showing the spectrum of broadcast spectrum on quasar, where the spectrum of the Giotto had not changed at all over 7 years, in the very high dispersion spectrum, it would then indicate that it would all be gaps in fact at quite large distances. It's constantly going from the Max Lambrecht.
Yeah.
Is that generally the case?
Well, I always had a problem with that argument because that argument is always assuming that the outflow is radial. And the distance you get is from saying that the acceleration is V squared over R. When you don't see acceleration, you have to put the distance very far away. But the absorption can much be very well described as a pattern when you don't see the same gas, you just see the gas in the same velocity.
Yep.
And then the argument becomes much weaker. So I don't count on that, but we do have very good evidence. Martin could have done a very good job on showing that the distance of some of these outflows is kiloparsecs from the nucleus. And then you have huge mega winds. On the other hand, we have other quasars that follows on the work that Dave Terchak has done. We now have high resolution data that shows that some of the cases, the absorption is inside the broad emission line region. So, you know, we are definitely talking about lots of different populations of these quasar waves. So we really don't know.
Daniel?
A class of Langevin-Vis waves which are very unstable. That's in contrast to high material of orders of magnitude. And you can change the variation of our order. So when I make it, yes, it's my kind of movie, I think it's moving up and down. But when I calculate synthetic Langevin-Vis, always the variations are not very common in the Langevin-Vis. So I would like to make a point that making the translation between, we don't see time variability in the line, to lack of time variability in the system, in the outer.
But do you see highly structured lines with many dips and sort of peaks, you know, like these beams?
Yeah, that's
any other comments or issues? Well, so yeah, aha, great.
Fascinated me was, I think, a remark that Carl made about extended relationship length of clusters. And I'd like to know if anybody can address the question of whether we will, in the coming years, have limits or measurements of black hole masses or analogy or whatever in global clusters.
The data there are very large proper motion studies on work with hydrogen and JX, and of course, I thought there are large proper motion studies for about a dozen black hole clusters. We have data now with proper motions you get extremely close to the center. So I would say in a year or two, we should have a fairly good estimate of these two clusters. So it's a dynamical line.
So if the relationship, so for all the theorists, if the relationship continues to grow in clusters, does that rule out any of the models?
Well, I think it just multiplies the number of models.
It's relatively hard to prevent collision runaway in certain types of star clusters. And if you have such a collision runaway where you make all kinds of collisions, then you tend to have it all with the same star, which you would have always thought before. And you grow to something that looks like a 15 or 15. And but it's only the case in the special class of clusters, you get a very small rotation time with a rotation driven process. If your rotation time is short enough, you build up a very massive object in a matter of a few million years. But if your rotation time is long, like in long a cluster like Omega Centauri or so, you can't do it because your stars will start disturbing the central dynamics
before you were able to build up very massive block count.
So in M15, if there isn't even such a massive object, well, let's say 2,000-tall mass black hole in the center. If you calculate the rotation time for M15 at the moment, that will be in the type of clusters which do not do it. I would be very surprised to find M15 in this class of objects. The only way you can prevent that is by making it likely that it will have such a growing object, is by reducing its rotation time by, for example, rotation. And the rotation is exactly what the car also will serve in this type of process. So everything seems to fit together in at least a theoretical framework.
So is what you're saying that if there is a 2,000 solar mass black hole, that came from a 2,000 solar mass star that collapsed?
Well, that is a very good question, I think. And that is something, maybe something else. it is very easy to build something that is very massive, but the question is, do you build a star which then collapses to a black hole, or you make a kind of seed black hole and that collapses something? For the stellar dynamics, it doesn't really matter very much, because the black hole is not the one carrying the cross-section. The cross-section is really gravitational-focused. I mean, yeah. It is not like playing darts or so. It's not shooting stars and it's not playing darts. Your dartboard is really very attractive. So you can throw your darts in a random direction and it will hit the dartboard anyway. You only hit the bullseye. So, what is anybody who has an opinion about that? Or, well, let's say opinion.
Well, what? I don't.
Roger?
No. I wanted to ask an additional question, which is if we do believe there are these limits on the mass of a black hole you can get from a single star, very large star, pop 3 star, something like that, evolving by itself, can you actually help it out if you have other stars merging with it at the same time? So you're continuously resetting the internal structure. Does that make it more unstable to blowing itself apart, or could that allow a larger mass to collapse gas dynamically?
Well, that may be something that happens in star clusters.
Yeah.
If indeed you smash stars into each other, the internal structure will be completely abnormal.
But remember, M15 is not a population 3.
Right.
Well, so then you have something like...
So then you
build
then
up
you
a
have the wings that...
Okay. Are there any more comments? Anyone want the last word? Daniel, yes.
You were talking about the feedback, right? With the fluctuation of material, for higher angular momentum material to be accretive, you would give me an outflow. And that outflow may bring the magnitude of the supply of the material. But on the other hand, you can get feedback that some of the angular momentum material is very low.
So in the end, you end up with a higher accretion rate without transporting angular momentum, maybe? Okay, any response, any other comments? If not, having resolved all the questions we set out to answer, I declare the session adjourned.